Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex. And welcome back to On Air. Dan, I'm joining you in the land of the maple syrup, where 70%, in fact, of the world's maple syrup is manufactured. Any guesses?
Mexico.
I'm in the great state of Quebec, baby.
Bonjour.
Bonjour from Montreal.
Have you run into
Canada.
Celine Dion yet?
Nope, no sightings. Although, where I ate for dinner last night, they informed me that Drake was here a week ago in the same restaurant.
Oh, really?
So yeah, you were like, so now I need to eat there every single night.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So that very purely you. On aviation matters, I need to be able to discuss his aircraft with him. Have you seen his?
He has a 767, right?
He does. He has a 767, which is not the youngest aircraft in the book, but
that's,
my God,
crazy. Like, I saw on Twitter today, like, Jeff Bezos' new G700 Gulfstream parked at Van Nuys. And they're like, yeah, of course, that's amazing. But it's still like not the most spacious inside. But that's his choice. Obviously, he can afford anything. And then it's like, oh, but Drake has a 767, which is just crazy.
I know. And to put that into perspective, where, you know, some of the world's top tier elite like Bezos would opt for a Gulfstream, a G700, which is the latest one that actually a QR was showing in Farnborough. It's quite rare to get the highest end of the elite opt for a former passenger aircraft converted into. So you're talking about an aircraft that, for example, United use on the transatlantic routes. That's the size of it. And they and Drake has it as his own Air Drake 767 kitted out. I mean, like, immensely. It's
even
crazy.
Even the two presidential candidates use 757s and occasionally 737s, and I was like,
so
but
America,
Drake has a wide body. Okay,
it does always make me, you know, realize the different worlds we live in when you refer to aircraft in the American 737 757 way, whereas I would be more inclined to say 737 757.
True. I feel like I just said that because we were talking about presidential candidates. But, you know, a minute ago I said 767 instead of 767. But everyone
cut you open and you are half one side of the Atlantic, half the other. So how have you been? How's your day going specifically?
Well, I've had a very Scandinavian Airlines day. Obviously, everyone knows they joined SkyTeam on Sunday. Funny day to join an alliance, but that's when the transition happened. And everything at the airline has been in shambles, not least their IT and their call center. So I've been trying to book an award ticket for my mom and my aunt, which is should be simple enough, but their website isn't really working. So I tried calling them and I spent 5 hours today on hold. Never got through because the call dropped. So by the end, like in the beginning, I was so annoyed by the hold music. But after 5 hours, like my brain was literally just blocking it out. I didn't even realize the music was there anymore. So that was fun.
Ouch. I'm assuming that that is not a charged call, right?
Yes, it was. But I call via Skype. Ooh. So I had like, okay. I used up my $15 in Skype credits on nothing, but not that it was too much money, but yeah.
Donating $15 to SAS isn't, you know, what anyone should be doing midweek.
Literally, it's, or not at all. I'm done. Yeah. After they were trying to be shady about my compensation claim this spring with that whole messy situation, trying to get from Heathrow to Gothenburg and then this and the general state, I'm just like, I'm so happy that I don't need to fly them almost at all anymore. I've flown them like twice in 2 years. But unfortunately, my family still lives in Scandinavia. So that means they have SAS credit cards. And a few times a year when they're planning vacations, it's like, Dan, can you please arrange this for us? And of course, I gladly do it. But
you can add me to that list. I'm gonna start sending you, you know, I don't know what to do with XYZ and say, Dan, can you please arrange this for me?
Put
me
on the family list. Literally, I think you wish you could do that.
No, I am going to be doing that, especially now I know that you do it for the family. I mean, if you do it for the family, you do it for the co-host, right?
family take that as a yes. Or podcast co-host? Who
come
comes
on,
first?
Come on. You don't speak to them every Wednesday for an hour and a half.
Well, yeah, technically I do spend less time with you across 5 podcast episodes than I did on hold with SAS today. So that's great.
Well, I am joining you in between sessions at ICAO, which is the United Nations Special Agency for Aviation that we've spoken about before. And to get the gist of what's been happening here, I've been here for quite a while already. I've been here now around 8 days, eight,
no
9 days.
Way.
Yeah, it's because also we had to interrupt the, I mean, ICAO was closed, the UN division and everything was closed because it was just Labor Day weekend, wasn't it, across all of North America, so US and Canada. And so that kind of extended the, you know, everything that we did on Friday wrapped up and then you can't resume until Tuesday morning. And so that kind of made things a little longer. But I'm super familiar with Montreal anyway. This is my 100th time here. I love the food scene here. So I feel every day. What?
What is it that you specifically like there?
I just think they have a real nice selection variety of restaurants of a mixture of cuisines, not specifically, for example, Canadian food, but everything. So there's an amazing Thai restaurant that I took some of my friends to last night. So good. Of course, we've eaten at some of the famous ones as well. There's a couple of great Asian restaurants. There's an Italian that I've been back twice. It's solid. There's a solid food scene for most destinations. I have a list on my notes, so
yeah,
I'll have Montreal that. And then I'll have, you know, the list of breakfast places, lunch places, dinner places, coffee, a takeaway, and then usually sometimes, and this, it's amazing how you think in the moment, oh, I'll remember it, but it's amazing how helpful it is when you then return to that place. Well, I will specifically say underneath, I'll write, don't order X, order Y, and ask for it this way, and it's amazing, whatever. And so it's nice to refer back to those lists, and I feel like the power of that list has really paid off, especially on this trip where usually the agenda is far more crammed for me when I'm in Montreal. It's an intense kind of 6 days or so, barely a minute to step out. But this has been far more relaxed. As I said, I had the whole long Labor Day weekend to eat out multiple times a day and just kind of... And the weather is typically Canadian. It's really hot on one day, which is great. And then yesterday I was absolutely freezing and I was getting out the hoodies and the jackets from the case that I left in the suitcase. So
you love a good hoodie day.
Yeah, I do. It's an excuse to wear 3 hoodies in one day. That was yesterday. But in ICAO, the sessions that we're having, basically, so that people understand kind of what this entity does as a UN organization, we've been working through a long list of what's called working papers, which are basically proposals and suggestions to ICAO as to what should be transformed or transferred or created or written into aviation law or aviation annexes or amendments to the existing legislative agenda that ICAO has as per the air laws and freedoms of the skies. So I'll give you an example. We'll have a working paper. I'll say this working paper is 127, and it is about GPS spoofing or signal jamming, which is rife at the moment. That's where some countries are using technology because they're involved in conflict to ultimately jam the signals, and it poses a threat to aviation because, for example, there was a Finnair aircraft that had to stop flying to Estonia because every time it was on approach and relying on the GPS to play its role during the arrival, it was unable to do so because the GPS was jammed and they couldn't see anything in the flight deck, and therefore they had to keep returning to Helsinki. They actually cancelled that route, and that was because of what's going on with Russia and Ukraine and everything happening there. A similar thing is happening because of the war in Gaza. If you fly, for example, to Cyprus, sometimes on radar, it can show that you're landing in Beirut. If you are, you know, anywhere near, if even the aircraft that are bound for Tel Aviv on radar, they show that they're at 100 feet above above Lebanon. So this kind of issue is really a hot topic at the moment. So they take that issue and then they say, okay, so there's certain countries that say, this is what we want to go into, you know, to be signed into the agenda of ICAO, the legislative agenda. We want to protect member states from the risk that this poses. We want to have a follow-up system when there is a violation. We want ICAO to intervene here. So they put that on the board, and then every country present, and you've got all those seats with the country names in front, they have to then debate that. And that debate can take 5 minutes or 3 days. It just depends how many people, how many countries have an opinion on it and want to speak. Some countries say, yep, we're all for this. This improves aviation safety. Others say, get out of our backyard. This is our sovereignty. Stop telling us what to do. And so it goes on and on and on. Whether or not it is successful in passing through the House, if you like, depends on how that debate session goes. That's what I've been doing for the last 9 days. So that's continuing now. I've just literally stepped out of a session to do the pod with you.
Yeah, it must be really interesting with different countries having different ideas about what's right. And another thing we have to hear about, you texted me a little bit, your flight over there, because it's always a fun day when Alex gets to fly a North American airline and we all want to hear about it. So
It was fine. I flew Air Canada on the 787-9 from London to Montreal. It's the nice afternoon flight, leaves at 2:05. Can I just say, hats off to them, just like the flight I did with them 6 months ago. We boarded so nice and early. It is the first time, maybe in about 10 years, that we departed. We were airborne 2 minutes prior to our scheduled departure time. I don't think I've ever left Heathrow at the departure time, never mind before. I felt like you with that Etihad flight where they left without you. Difference is I was on it. It was really that, so that's nice. I know their product well, you know, and I like the seat. It is pretty private and the IFE is great. The best thing about it is the gate-to-gate Wi-Fi. From the moment you sit down, I bought a stream pass for about $20.
Wow,
so valid for the whole flight. And that was great because it's gate to gate with no interruption the whole way, considering we're flying over Greenland and the Atlantic and so on. So that's great. Just a couple of small notes on Air Canada. Okay. Firstly, considering those transatlantic tickets can be around $10,000 Canadian, I am surprised how chill the demographic of passengers in business class are.
So
and by
true.
That, I mean, like, they're like not asking for anything. They are not even expecting anything. I challenge that to happen in the Middle East or Asia or Southeast Asia, because it's as if these passengers go expecting absolutely nothing. And I say that because when you board, like they, for example, he came to me and I was in 2 Alpha. He came to me and he was like, hey, do you want a sparkling water or, you know, the pre-prepared thing on the dish? And I said, no, but can I have a bottle of water, please? Because I noticed every seat had a bottle of water, but mine wasn't there. And he was like, oh, is it not there? I said, no. He was, and I just boarded, right? I was still standing. I'd just gone. And we're staring at the seat and he's staring with me. He was like, it's not, did you not? I was like, no, I've just arrived. He was, oh, okay. So then he told the other crew and he was like, there's no bottle of water there, 2A. And he was like, really? Thinking, what are you guys doing? Just give me a bottle of water.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, you know, so much discussion, so much pointless discussion. Anyway, so fine, airborne. Have the, we get airborne immediately. Funnily enough, not the place I expected to encounter heavy, moderate turbulence at 32,000 feet over Leeds, of all places.
That's
crazy, right, for about 30 seconds. Anyway, they start the meal service immediately. And of course, hey, welcome to North America, where they're going to tell you when you're going to eat, right?
Yeah.
So,
well, most airlines, to be fair.
Yeah. Yeah, welcome to most airlines, true. So they start the service and they're like doing it really quickly, like the drinks and then the main. And of course, everything is served together and it's all served on a tray. And I'm sorry, but there's just nothing premium about that. When you realize the ticket prices, I sent a Snapchat picture to Demi, to my sister, and she replied to me saying, for $10,000, I don't want to see a trolley in the aisle.
My like, yeah, favorite right. message I've ever received is when I posted a story from Emirates old 777 business class a few months ago, and Demi responds to my story, oh, ? I was like, what does this mean?
Did she ever clarify or not?
Yeah, I had to ask you. I don't think you were. I just said to you, I was like, what is this? And then she's like, I love her.
Yeah. So, yeah, welcome to every other airline. Exactly. So she, so they do this very quick meal service. We've only been airborne for about 40 minutes, 45 minutes. And then the food quality, you know, it's unfortunately wasn't good at all. And I barely ate as a result of that because I opted for the tortellini pasta and it was hard. I mean, it was not edible, and I was in the, especially when the edges are kind of really hard, so it's not been cooked through properly. And the salad is like, you know, not a salad. It's just like scraps, like small bowl of rabbit food. And and that's it. And there's a lot of focus on, I mean, a huge wine list. And so a lot of focus on alcohol, but again, no one's asking for anything. And you can notice because the cabin is pretty open, isn't it? So you can,
yeah.
So I was, and it's a daytime flight. So they serve everything. The meal service is done literally 1 hour into the flight.
Yeah.
So now we have 5.5 hours left of nothing. And that astounds me that there's, for example, you know, I was texting my friends during the flight. They were saying, so if you're hungry, why don't you order something else? I was like, that's it. There is not anything else. Like, that's it. So he was like, we should check. So I was like, all right, is there anything else to eat? He was like, yeah, we have the snack basket at the front. And he's like, points at this little basket. With
overcompensating with the R's, are we?
Yeah, true. He's like, we have this what do you call it? Snack basket at the front. And he points at this basket with crisps, chips, you know, just packs of crisps. That's it. So I was thinking, okay, you know, this is in terms of food and beverage, I thought it was poor. That was the first thing. I knew to expect that anyway. I went with loads and loads of snacks, spent about £35 in M&S before I boarded. So I was not going to starve on this 6.5 hour flight where I knew that, you know, you eat once and not again.
Yeah.
But I had one issue, and this is the only other thing. The crew were fine. Okay, they were friendly, and I mean, don't get me wrong. It is like a shock to the system after when you are based in the Middle East and you're flying Middle East and Asian carriers. For example, the loud, inappropriate conversation between crew in the galley, where one crew is in the cabin and the other one is like, you know, saying things like, "Just you wait, see what I'm gonna do to you," and I'm thinking, are they not? Like, we can all hear this. And again, every other passenger, blissfully unaware. And I'm looking like, what are you guys doing? Being so loud and having this weird, wild conversation in front of everybody. But, you know, they don't care. They don't care. But I had one issue, which is different to last year, 6 months ago's flight, okay? Which is, the flight departed at 2:05 p.m., okay? The flight arrives in Montreal at 1600 local time. So it is a perfect afternoon westbound flight, right? You have a full night in your bed in London. You can even sleep in because the flight is at 2, right? And when you arrive in Montreal, it's lovely, you know, still early afternoon, 4 p.m. You've got your afternoon, evening, and then bed, okay? So you're fine. Can I ask why at 3:30 p.m. local time, immediately after the meal service had finished, once again we were put into complete darkness, which I found absolutely inappropriate.
Biggest pet peeve. You know, I hate that too. And again, like, okay, we just have to talk about this because the fact you're talking about how North American passengers board a $10,000 flight like it's nothing, like they're taking the bus. And you're just like...
Yeah, and they just don't expect anything. I get Canadians are like the most polite population on earth, as they say. But like, if you're spending that much money, are you not... I mean, how are they were... I saw a few elderly. It was mostly elderly in the cabin, probably spending their pensions, bless them. And they got up at like hour four looking for food and, but just, you know, going to the snack basket, taking a bag of crisps. And I'm thinking, what must they think when they fly in the Middle East and they are presented with a dine on demand, a la carte, eat as much as you want, whenever you want, how you want menu, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that people, like, sometimes people don't even understand, like, sometimes you don't realize the difference even when you're experiencing the thing that's more luxurious because you don't know what to look for. Like, I remember the first few times I flew Middle Eastern Airlines in 2016 or so. And like, I didn't register the fact that, for example, the crew would kneel to take my order or to talk to me, which is incredible. Like, they don't have to do that. Absolutely not. But only in hindsight, looking back after I, you know, after several flights, I was like, oh my gosh, they did kneel. That's so nice. Those types of things. Also,
and that's not because that is. It's important to note there that they are not kneeling in that service because it's kind of like this, you know, servant style status thing. They're doing it because if you are sitting, they would rather they feel it's more polite to speak with you at your level rather than looking down at you, right, exactly, while they're standing. So they're coming down to your level so that you can have that face-to-face warmer interaction.
Yeah, exactly. And can I tell you about my flights now, speaking of this, because I've just flew China Southern for the first time, and I was blown away by the service. When I say probably top 5 or at least top 10 in flight service experiences I've ever had, including Singapore Airlines first class, it was absolutely mind-blowing. So we had a flight attendant called Rebecca. Specifically, the very best was from flying from Bali to Guangzhou, which is like the most leisure route in the history of humanity. I get on, the flight attendant immediately goes, welcomes us by name, guides us to our seats. She says, I know you're connecting with us to here. We're very excited to have you on board. How's your stay in Bali? Starts asking us about that. My name is Rebecca. I'll be taking care of you. Would you like your slippers? Oh, certainly. Takes them out of the wrapping, puts them by our feet, which I've only had before in Singapore Airlines first class. Someone do that. And everything was so...
It's hotel style, isn't it?
It's beyond. It was so personalized and incredible. And on the next flight, again, like, I go to the lounge. I always do this because I'm recording out of the window. Normally, the window is kind of... Unfortunately, people put their, like, hands or even greasy faces on the windows. So when you think about it, since I'm trying to record, there's almost always stains on it. So I go to the bathroom. Yeah. Well, first I sanitize, and then I go to the bathroom to get some tissues to dry it so I have a clear window to record out of. So I go to the bathroom, and the crew go, oh, what, can we help you with anything? I go, no, don't, never mind. I'm just getting a tissue. Please, sir, we'll come to your seat. You could have just called us. We could have brought you a tissue. Please don't do this again. I was like in the nicest way. I was just like, this is beyond. It was so incredible. And then
that's extra.
And then she goes, oh, just, she comes by a minute later, just in case, with a wad of tissues for me. Absolutely so unexpected too, because that's not what you hear about China Southern, you know?
No. So did you get lucky, or is that China Southern?
I don't know, but both my flights, the service was really good, especially the first one was just mind-blowing. I had to write...
Was it a 787?
The first flight from Bali to Guangzhou, which is 5 hours was an A321 Neo. So, you know, equipment, not the best, but yeah, for five hours, it was fine. And yeah, I had to make sure to write a compliment for how I'm. Oh, yeah. And another thing was China Southern, weirdly, doesn't offer special meals for breakfast flights for whatever reason. Okay. So we told that to Rebecca, who was taking care of us. And she's like, oh, my goodness. I'm so sorry. Listen, I'm going to find anything I can and scrape it together. And I'm like, surely there are no vegan crew meals or anything on Chinese airlines. She goes, no, I'll look in all our meals and I'll take the vegetables and put them together for you. I'm like, please don't do that. You have to eat. Yeah. We really don't. Because we ate a ton beforehand knowing we wouldn't get food on this flight. She's like, no, no way. Please let me prepare something for you. And by the way, they had no idea I'm a YouTuber or anything.
Glad you clarified that point because we were all thinking it.
Yeah, because YouTube doesn't. YouTube is illegal in China. It's blocked, first of all. But there was no indication whatsoever. And when I was recording, they didn't seem to register that, you know, it was for anything in specific. Yeah. So, yeah.
That's really good. That's good. So, I mean, so one of your flights was on the 787 after, right?
Yeah, my connection.
Yeah. Did they dim the windows?
So that's another thing. They dimmed them to just one level down, but they didn't lock them. And that's the big frustration. I don't understand.
So that's, why I think I should have clarified better when I had told you just a few minutes ago about what, when I said, oh, they put us into darkness. By the way, I don't mean to the listeners that, I don't mean that they turned off the lights in the cabin. Yeah, they did that. But because it's the 787, which the crew can control, they've got the electronic dimmable windows, it gives the crew this power to be able to dim the windows and also, scarily, lock them, right? So that you are unable to brighten the window to reveal natural light outside because it's locked. So I'm sitting knowing that I've got a nice, comfortable, hopefully 6 hour daytime flight. I had a bunch of work to catch up with, had excellent Wi-Fi. So I literally set up my little mobile office. I had the FT to read cover to cover, the New York Times, whatever. And as I am preparing and to do all of that, and I've set it all up and I start, suddenly everything goes dark, including my windows now in front of me going into the
pitch black mode.
So, yeah, and I hate that because you didn't ask anyone. Also, it's a daytime flight. 6 months ago when I did this flight, it was daylight the whole way and nobody even slept because, you know, why would you? And if you are going to sleep because you've got the flat bed, for example, then they're doing that as like a casual nap. No one's treating it as an overnight.
And there
are
reasons there are eye masks in amenity kits.
And there are reasons there are eye masks in the amenity kits. So, the moment my window went dark, along with everyone else's, I was thinking, no way am I now sitting in a dark cabin for the next 4 hours, 45 minutes. So I tried to catch the attention of the crew. But of course, once the meal service is done, nobody reemerges back into the cabin.
Yeah.
And I say this, the crew were like, on the most part, were nice. Like they were okay, but it's kind of basic, isn't it? It's very, very basic level interaction and kind of bare minimum. And that's, I guess, a problem with the service rather as a whole, rather than the individuals. So I'm trying to catch the attention because I always hate being the guy that presses the button. I try to avoid pressing the call button at all costs. Yeah. I just think it starts that interaction off in a bad way. Anyway, so I'm forced to press it. So I press service light and wait a minute. And the purser, I don't know what they call it on Air Canada, but the head crew came over. He was like, hi. I said, hi, could you please unlock my window? And he was like, he just reacted shocked. He was like, what? I said, yeah, because I don't want to sit in the dark for the next 4 hours, 45 minutes. So if you wouldn't mind just unlocking my window, please, so I can put it back to as it was, which was, you know, open. And he goes, if it's light you're looking for, we have this overhead reading light.
Which
I said,
does
not. Yeah, sorry, I want natural daylight. I don't want to sit under an artificial light bulb for the next 4 hours, 45 minutes. So if you can just open my window shade, please, that'd be much appreciated. He goes, it's going to let light into the cabin and people want to sleep. I looked around and I was like, respectfully, I said to him, I'm not sure were told that the cabin are going to sleep. It's a 2 p.m.
You should have said, respectfully, I think you're the one who wants people to sleep.
Yeah, you guys want to do not. Exactly. Listen, we know what's going on, but I'm trying to keep the interaction with him as polite and chill as possible, right? Where I could really say, listen, I know what you're doing. You're putting the window shades down. You're turning the temperature up and you're hoping we all fall asleep so that you guys can do nothing, yeah. You know? So anyway, I didn't say that. So I said to him, respectfully, it's a 2 p.m. departure on a westbound daytime flight and we land at 4. If anyone now sleeps the next 5 hours, they've wrecked themselves with jet lag, but that's their choice. And you know, they've got eye masks in the amenity kit. So if I would still like it open. He goes, but if I open it, it's going to flood the cabin with daylight. So now this is his third pushback.
That's crazy.
Yes, I'm aware of that, but I would like my window shade open, please. And he was like, okay, I'm going to do it. I am going to do it. But I'm telling you that, you know, the people around you that are going to want sleep, you know, it's going to be now daylight for them and blah, blah, blah. I said to him, and again, it's a daytime westbound 2 p.m. departure and people have eye masks. And also, you know, the way the seats are staggered,
yeah.
It's kind of private, isn't it? So I was even kind of analyzing this. My daylight doesn't actually hit the seats next to me because the wall of their business shell, you know, is blocking it because of the staggered arrangement. So he was like, I'm going to unlock it to the second one, though, only. Okay, not the first one.
Oh my God.
Of course, I compromised. I said to him, all right. So I said, I'll try the second one and if it's okay. So then he went back and he unlocked it. And I had to manually raise the window up to the highest level, which is 2. It won't go any higher. So 1 is full daylight. So I leave it on 2. And, you know, it's enough. Of course, it's enough light for me to be able to read and see and do things. Not as much as I wanted.
Yeah.
Okay. But it was enough. And then he kind of peered through the curtain and he was like, okay, like, you know, like, you happy? And I was like, thank you. And I just thought, that's so unnecessary. It was a daytime flight. Yeah. Why did you have to make me go through that awkward interaction? And guess what? Nobody slept. Of course, nobody slept. It was a daytime 2 p.m. departure.
I just wish they left. And you know, that's what I personally like about flying European airlines across the Atlantic, because much more often the crew does not make everyone close the window shades. And people also look out. In North America, even during takeoff and landing, half the window shades are shut. But when I flew BA...
Which is against the law in Europe.
Yeah, exactly. But when I flew BA to Miami in April... I was shocked because 2/3 of the cabin at least had their window shades open the entire flight. And I was thinking, when was the last time I was on a transatlantic flight and this happened? And then I thought, oh my gosh, it's because I'm surrounded by Europeans, which is great.
And our aircraft flew directly over Greenland and over all of the ice and the snow. And it was amazing. Of course, none of the passengers in that cabin were aware because they were all sitting in the dark. I was the only one that could see it. And another thing about the demographic is that they didn't question anything. So I'm just amazed. For example, the window shades go black. Nobody does anything. No. I didn't see a single person attempt to even... It's as if they're just sitting there at the mercy of, you know, of being told what to do.
It's a shame.
Guys, you are allowed to open your window shades. You know, if that same flight I was on was operated by a 777, for example, they wouldn't be walking over to me saying, put your window blind down, because it would be a far more confrontational, you know, request from the crew side. And therefore, they wouldn't ask you to put it down. I just don't like this trigger happy thing on a 787. And I spoke to someone at Air Canada after, and he said to me, it's not standard operating procedure. They're not meant to put the cabin into darkness on a 2 p.m. daytime westbound flight between London and Montreal. And thank you for flagging.
Yeah. I can't believe, like, I know this is a thing now on Airbus jets. I've even experienced those window shades too. But when they introduced it, I was just like, no way this is where we're going on the A350 as well. Because that was one of many things that made the A350 so much nicer than the 787. But no, I mean, that's now no longer the case. One thing though, which you're going to love this hack. I hope some listeners do as well. So this works on some. It hasn't worked every time, but
I think I know it.
You can kind of work your magic because there's a reset function. If
yes, it didn't work on this flight. I tried it. Yes, I tried it.
It is supposed to unlock. So if any of you listening are on a 787 flight where they seemingly lock them, try holding either up or down for 10 seconds and it might unlock and the crew will think you're magic and you'll have, you know, a nice view outside, which is great.
Yeah, they're going to love you.
Yeah, exactly.
The Wi-Fi was so good, I was texting my engineer friends who work on Boeing aircraft. How do I override the window blind feature? They've locked it. I said, how do I? So they said to me, hold the top, the open shade for about 15 seconds. Literally, your finger starts aching. I said, no, nothing. He said, okay, hold the bottom one. Nothing. He said, okay, hold both together. It felt like you're doing it with an Apple iPhone, you know. Yeah. Like, so I'm holding both together 15 seconds. Nothing. He was like, damn, that locked it real good.
Right. Real good. One more thing before we get into news, we've been chatting a long time, but just thinking about your crew belt thing, which is so crazy because it's right that in North America, especially, pressing the crew belt is super taboo and you're not supposed to do it if it's not like an emergency in theory, which is crazy. That's how the crew view it. But I mean, really you can call it for whatever. But again, on China Southern, they said something I've never heard before. So immediately after wheels went off the ground, they said, we're going to be leaving the seatbelt sign on for a while, obviously, till we reach cruising altitude to make sure it's safe for you to move around. But if you need anything urgently, please press and unpress the crew call bell continuously and we'll come and help you.
Oh my God.
I was just like, can you imagine if you did that in the US? Just went ding, 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 ding.
Wow. Okay. That is
different.
That's something. Did anybody do that?
No, not that I could see. But yeah, it was a really fun experience transiting in China. Obviously, done it many times before, but everything is just slightly different. Okay, so speaking of the China, greater China area around there, there has been some quite surprising news, I would say, from Cathay Pacific over the past few days. And
yeah,
it leads to a lot of questions. So do you want to tell us what's going on?
Yeah, so we'll kick things off by explaining what is happening. And all of this is relevant just prior to us publishing on Wednesday. So in case there are any further developments, that's that out of the way. But with this, I mean, the headline that you guys need to be aware of is that Cathay Pacific, of course, the Hong Kong-based One World Alliance airline, is inspecting 48 operational Airbus A350 aircraft. It has actually grounded its A350-1000 jets because it has identified a problem in relation to a fuel nozzle on the Rolls-Royce engines. So how this kind of came about is that several minutes after takeoff of following flight Cathay 383 from Hong Kong to Zurich just on Monday, the aircraft performed two pretty wide circles and dumped fuel, being made aware of an issue to do with fuel and the engines.
There was a fire warning or something, right?
Correct. So it returned to Hong Kong, where it landed around 75 minutes after being airborne. And they had identified later, once the aircraft was on the ground, that something specifically related to the fuel nozzle inside of the XWB-97 engine. So this is a Rolls-Royce engine that is specific to the A350-1000. It is a different version of engine, a different variant of the engine that is on the A350-900, which of course there are more in service globally. This fuel nozzle is a component that somehow, and the investigation continues, malfunctioned, and therefore needs some kind of replacement. And the reason it all sounds a bit vague is because we are still really early days into this. But Cathay is having to inspect these aircraft, and therefore they are now on the ground. And when they had been made aware of the problem on the aircraft that was bound for Zurich, they then thought, okay, it's time to check the other aircraft. And they have 18 A350-1000s of the total A350 fleet. It has identified that out of the 18 A350-1000s, 15 of them have the issue and require replacements. Three already going through repairs right now. Rolls-Royce said that the replacement can take place while the engine stays on the wing. Now, that's crucial in terms of how long these aircraft will be grounded for. And that, of course, you can imagine it is cooperating with an investigation that is being led by Cathay Pacific, but also Airbus, Rolls-Royce, and different civil aviation authorities worldwide, including China. It's concerning because there are many A350-1000s in service and operational all over the world, and any grounding is a little bit of a red flag to all the other carriers to get their inspections underway. And I would say that the key part of everything I've outlined is the bit that 15 aircraft out of the 18 have the issue. That suggests it's
quite bad.
Pretty much. Yeah, it's all of them, probably all of them that were delivered into a certain date.
So with all these groundings at Cathay, and considering they found this problem on 15 aircraft, why haven't we seen any other airlines seemingly react yet?
Well, we're starting to, and that's because we are still really early days into this. But now the other airlines that operate A350-1000 specifically are now having to begin their inspections. And it is something that Rolls-Royce is in contact with them about. And therefore, when these aircraft are returning back to their respective hubs, they are now undergoing these checks. So it is likely that over the coming hours and days, we might see further airlines come forward to say that they have a similar issue, which would most likely result in some form of either partial or full grounding of the A350-1000s. Now, to put this into perspective as to what we could be looking at the impact globally, the largest six operators of the A350-1000s, number one is Qatar Airways. They've got 24 A350-1000s. British Airways have 18, the same as Cathay, which also have 18. Virgin Atlantic have 12. And Etihad and Japan Airlines have 5 each. Cathay have been forced to cancel multiple flights because their fleet is out of action while these inspections continue. They've cancelled at least 34 round-trip flights between Hong Kong and destinations including Sydney, Osaka, Tokyo, Taipei, Bangkok, and Singapore. The situation remains fluid, as I said, and there'll be further updates every single day. Japan Airlines, which, as I said to you, has 5. All of the 5 that Japan Airlines has, they are less than a year old. If you remember, I was at the delivery of the first one in December at Airbus. So they have said that they are not suspending A350 flights in the meantime, but they are awaiting advisories from Rolls-Royce and inspections will begin. Singapore Airlines, which has the A350-900, has said that they are now initiating a fresh round of inspections on the aircraft. They believe they won't be affected because it is a different engine that is on the A350-900 to the A350-1000, which is larger. But nevertheless, you know, aviation being on the side of caution that it has to be on and being so safety focused in Southeast Asia as they are initiating those inspections over these coming hours. It's one of these wait and see moments that we just hope doesn't, you know, we hope it isn't anything too serious, and rather it's just that, okay, it's better to be, you know, safe and have an element of precaution in these scenarios, but of course concerning, because it is concerning whenever an airline discovers something that is in a vital fundamental part of the airframe or the aircraft, such as the engines, and seemingly it's, you know, a decision between Rolls-Royce and Cathay that they should ground. What does that then mean for the other operators?
Yeah. Well, so far, thank goodness, it seems like Cathay Pacific has already got some of the A350-1000s back up and running. So at least it seems like the fix, from what we know now, isn't taking too long, right?
Well, they had said, so Cathay, if I just bring this up, Cathay had said that they had already completed the fix on 2 or 3, or were completing rather, and therefore expected those to re-enter service. That suggests that they are aware that it's just a replacement of a key component with the fuel nozzle, and therefore, hopefully, assuming that the checks a fulfilled post replacement, then it should mean that it's nothing too much of a problem. While we're on the subject of groundings, Dan, here we are again with the 777X continue. You know, that test fleet is still grounded in the background. That has left, I feel that's left the very forefront of aviation media and news, and is just in the background somewhere. The 777X is still grounded. Okay,
because I feel people aren't surprised anymore. It's just
they're
like,
not surprised.
Here we go again.
Yeah, I discuss it with some of the delegates here at ICAO, and you know they say, "Oh yeah, this is going to have the same issue as the MAX." I'm thinking, "Dear God, I hope you're wrong."
Yeah, I hope so for every airline's sake more than anything.
In other areas of the news, we saw a little surprising development from Virgin Atlantic that, I mean, this is an airline, in my opinion, that is a little lost in terms of network. And we've spoken about this when we did a pretty Virgin Atlantic heavy episode a number of weeks ago. If you missed it, you can go back in the feed. We gave it was on the back of a few questions we got about the airline, and we had a little deep dive, didn't we, of both Virgin and BA. Mm-hmm. And Virgin, of course, relatively small airline, but a big player as part of, you know, the UK transatlantic route with the US. I just feel that their strategy with route network is like trial and error, trial and error, trial and error, trial and error. Does this work? Oh, no, it doesn't work. Okay, we'll cut it after 1 year. Should we try this? Oh, it doesn't work. So we'll cut it after a year. And I just feel that erratic kind of instability is further evident in the decisions that, okay, yes, we understand why they've pulled out of China. So Virgin Atlantic will be axing their route to Shanghai, abandoning it because of the high costs associated with avoiding Russian airspace, which we discussed a couple of episodes ago. But also they're pulling out of the Bahamas, Turks and Caicos as well, only after 2 seasons. So, you know, there's this kind of this attitude with our route network of trying things. And their latest attempt, which I find really, really surprising, and I have no idea the rationale behind this, is that Virgin Atlantic is starting flights to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
Well, they know that, they understand the brand is Riyadh. That's what's going on here. They saw what Riyadh Air is doing, and they said, we want
in. That.
It would make sense for them to partner with Riyadh Air, and in that way, maybe this route could make a bit more sense. But to me, it's like, it is very tough, especially in the winter, for airlines to know where to fly. So Saudi is an interesting choice. I think we both know some expats who live in Riyadh, for example, who fly back to the UK quite a bit, and most of them go on British Airways. I'm sure they'd be happy to have Virgin as an option. But, you know, if I were to be more creative and say, where should they send their aircraft? They already relaunched their route to Dubai last winter. And I think in the winter from the UK at this point, Dubai is just like a guaranteed hit. You can get quite premium traffic. So,
but Riyadh point to point?
No, doesn't make
Virgin
sense.
Virgin Atlantic's demographic of travelers, does that make sense?
Not at all. So I would say, like, why instead they should have sent, you know, one of their Manchester-based E350s or whatever and launched Manchester to Dubai or something like that.
Yeah.
Because London to Riyadh, specifically for the brand Virgin Atlantic, just doesn't seem to make sense to me. And, you know, similarly, they're also launching flights to Accra, Ghana around the same time, which perhaps could make more sense given the big Ghanaian diaspora in the UK.
Yeah.
And they also feel maybe like they're more down for the very fun vibe of Virgin Atlantic. I don't know.
I mean, look, I can get that. The Accra, Ghana route, I can, as you say, I can kind of see how that makes sense given the makeup of and the heritage of so many different demographics in the UK, and there's a strong visiting friends and relative market there and so on. But the Saudi route, I mean, Saudis are not going to be flying Virgin Atlantic between Riyadh and London, because Saudis traveling to London need flexibility, they need frequencies, they need multiple flights, they earn points, so I just can't see how, I mean, so many Saudis go to London either with Saudia or via Dubai with Emirates or via Doha with Qatar Airways.
Yeah.
And so there's, you know, I can't see how Virgin Atlantic would be the attractive once daily option. The second point is that, I mean, they described it as that they hope that in the they hope that they can remain profitable in the winter months, given that Saudi is, you know, transforming its economy to attract luxury tourism. Don't get me wrong, Saudi is investing in huge plans to be able to have some form of, you know, tourism industry that and become a destination that people actually want to spend time in. Has that happened yet? No. Is it happening over the next year? Not really. No. I mean,
they're just kind way of a slow pace.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, Virgin said that they had foreseen that there would be a demand for Saudi Arabia over the next 10 years. I would say, yeah, you know, that I can see how that would be the case. But starting from the winter, I don't know. I just think that we will revisit this episode on the podcast when Virgin Atlantic acts this route, to be honest. Because and that's not out of character for Virgin. They launch an axe and launch an axe and launch an axe. And this is what they do.
Yeah. You know what's kind of funny to me is thinking back, this is giving me the same vibe as when you look at photos or read something from like 2012, 2013, and you see like Lufthansa and was it even KLM flying to Doha? Yeah. And you're like, that just seems so before its time in every way. But yet they were flying there and it worked somehow. So I see this Riyadh route as something that will probably be axed after this winter. But then in 10 years, maybe we'll see it come back and then it will make sense. It's just about...
The other thing is that don't forget... The route is not actually starting this winter. The route to Riyadh is starting in March 2025, just in time for Ramadan and then for the hot, hot summers where everybody leaves the Gulf. Not everybody, but, you know, a significant portion of the population end up leaving the Gulf because it's so hot. So even the timing of that, had they have said it was an October start, I'd be like, okay, maybe they can have, you know, a solid initial winter season, but... I don't see this working. Somebody described it on one of the websites that was commentating about this as they put, I want to find it. They said, at this point, quote, it starts to look like Virgin Atlantic is almost throwing darts at a map to see where it can add routes.
Yeah, it's kind of true. And one thing that fascinates me as well is the fact that London to Bangkok just doesn't seem to work. It works for Thai Airways, but... To me, that seems like the most obvious route in a way going east or Singapore for that matter. But, you know, Thailand is such a popular tourist destination, yet British Airways has historically really struggled in that market and currently doesn't serve it from London Heathrow. I think are they relaunching that from Gatwick this winter?
They are, yes, which I think was a disappointment for many because they wanted it back from Heathrow.
Yeah, but even, you know, before it was axed from Heathrow, it was a 787-8, so the tiniest long-haul aircraft in their fleet, and the Gatwick to Bangkok route will be three times weekly. And again, it's like, yes, it's not a very premium market in terms of the traffic, but it's still such... You know, you look at Lufthansa, they fly an A380, or they did pre-COVID, to Bangkok. And there are some, you know, Emirates flies five or six times a day. Qatar Airways flies five or six times a day. Turkish flies three times a day. So there is demand from Europe, but somehow, I guess people just aren't willing to pay the premium to go direct, and especially not the kind of prices in premium cabins that make that a sensible route. So,
and they're competing with airlines that are able to be really competitive on price point and offer them connections via the Middle East, for example. And
I don't know, but also Bangkok to me feels like such a Virgin Atlantic route, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Like I can see where they would have their like spice and flair on that. I mean, you know, definitely.
It's the perfect kind of brand match, but
they must have considered it. They must have considered it. I just think that of all destinations, I think it's... without clear strategy that they are going to, because again, as I said, the Saudi, let's look at the Saudis that are the ones flying to and from Saudi Arabia, from and then to back to Saudi Arabia. They have also the choice of British Airways, where at least they can maintain their, you know, the way in which they're able to collect Avios and so many Saudis are top tier frequent flyers on Qatar Airways, for example, and on Emirates, because they are able to leverage the wider route networks of their neighboring Gulf countries. And those neighbors have also set up for optimum, you know, nice, smooth, easy connections that specifically facilitate routes to and from Saudi. So, for example, the last time I went to South Korea in April, the quad behind me had four Saudi girls, and they were going on their girls' trip to South Korea. And they were explaining to me that South Korea has become really popular in terms of the South Korean culture, music, and food shows and so on in Saudi, and via things like TikTok and whatever. And so, you know, they were flying to South Korea from Riyadh. They were all based in Riyadh, and they were doing it through QR. And I said, why have you chosen, you know, so many different ways to get there? And they said, oh, because we wanted the Q Suite quad, you know. And they were saying, oh, we are all frequent flyers on QR. And the same is true if you go to, for example, the route in summer between Doha and Malaga in the south of Spain. You know that I would do that a lot. Most of that cabin in business class, they were all Saudis. That's recognizing that Saudia have a direct flight to Malaga, but they were still all choosing to fly with QR. Virgin Atlantic's going to compete with Saudia and BA and the neighboring Emirates and Qatar.
Yeah,
to bring Saudis to London, it's not going to happen.
Good luck, Virgin Atlantic. We're rooting for you anyway because they're such a good.
I'm rooting for the financial health of the airline, but I'm not rooting for, you know, ill thought decisions throwing a dart at a map.
We're rooting for their success. Let's say that.
Yeah.
So our final topic for today is an interesting one, something we've discussed before. But we are seeing...
Not with such detail.
No.
Because now we have tea.
Yeah, we have real Portuguese-German tea because Lufthansa is out shopping on a little shopping spree. Of course, Lufthansa Group...
Lock up your daughters. Lufthansa's in town.
So, of course, Lufthansa own Swiss, Brussels Airlines, Austrian Airlines, Discover, Eurowings... And now they're looking to add another airline to the list. And, you know, as opposed to SAS getting bought by Air France KLM, a stake at least, which was kind of a wild card, this makes a little more sense just looking partnership wise. But Lufthansa is looking to invest in TAP Portugal, the struggling Portuguese airline.
And for context, TAP is currently owned by the Portuguese government. And the government have been very public about their plans to privatize the airline. But Lufthansa CEO Carsten Spohr has traveled to Portugal this week trying to set up what will be Luft taking a 19.9% stake in TAP Air Portugal. And the reason it's 19.9% stake is because anything under a 20% stake means that Lufthansa Group doesn't need permission from the European Union for the deal. And the European Union has been really like active in terms of what it was trying to, the role it was trying to play, well, the European Commission rather, the role it was trying to play with the ITA Airways deal and Luft and kind of trying to stand up for the consumer and for competition and all of this. And so a 19.9% stake lets Lufthansa slide into the DMs of TAP Air Portugal, swoop it up, take it as their own, at least 19.9% of their own, and the European Commission never even have to receive an email about it. But the stake will eventually look to increase, just as the original plans were, once Luft is done with its Italy domination with ITA Airways. So it's, you know, European consolidation, again, we've discussed before, it's just something that we are going to continue to see these big players rule Europe. IAG, BA, Iberia, Level, Vueling, Aer Lingus, all one under the International Airlines Group. And the other part of Europe, everyone pretty much under the Lufthansa Group, with the third group that is quickly growing in Air France KLM. For the consumer, it's not always the best thing, and that's what we keep our eye on, and that's what we hope that the governments that serve us will bear in mind when they're trying to act in the best interests of we, the people.
Definitely. And of course, Lufthansa is already acquiring a stake in ITA Airways, taking airline out of SkyTeam, and now they're looking to expand even more. And for me, I wouldn't be as upset if this was either IAG or Air France-KLM, but specifically with Lufthansa Group. They have a habit, and also very interesting proof we found this week of how messy the group is internally, because there was another story that came out about Swiss, who's installing the new Allegris first class on their existing A330-300s. And suddenly now, you know, luckily the first class wasn't revealed in 2017, but it has been revealed and of course tested. Now Swiss finds out, hang on, it's too heavy for our A330-300s. It's going to make the aircraft nose heavy, which doesn't work. So they need to add several tons of weight in the back of the aircraft, which obviously makes no sense from a fuel efficiency standpoint, sustainability standpoint. So what does Swiss say? Well, what has kind of come out is that apparently there is a complete lack of communication within the group. So Lufthansa as an airline will say, this is the first class we're all going with. And then Swiss is kind of like, okay, but we need to install it on an aircraft type that you're not planning on installing it on. And now they find out it doesn't really work. So it's just an example of, you know,
I wasn't surprised to read that communication is not there across the group.
No.
And also, you know, there are so many employees that I've spoken to, senior employees, we're talking VP level and above, that have had to fight with Lufthansa HQ because their respective airlines have constantly being dragged down the Lufthansa way, and you know they've got brands that they want to protect. You know, remember that Brussels Airlines, the CEO of Lufthansa Group, Carsten Spohr, was more than happy to have Brussels Airlines just lose its identity completely, which really upset the people of Belgium and ultimately their long historic brand that Brussels Airlines is and used to be in the back in the Sabina days. Sabiha or Sabina?
Sabina.
Sabina, yeah. Why do I think Sabiha?
Sabiha is Istanbul's secondary airport.
Oh, yes. Sabiha is Istanbul. Yes. Okay, let's get confused. Sabina. And also the same applies for Austria. And Austrians had to hold on, you know, pretty firm to have that brand.
I mean, Brussels Airlines and Austrian have really been abused and tossed around by Lufthansa.
Definitely.
Austrian has had the most rickety old fleet. And they have had to really be like, oh, we're making money on this long haul route, but we need to scrap it because this aircraft needs to go here. We don't, you know, Lufthansa won't send us any more planes. They won't send us any new planes. And that has
It's exactly. It's only just started. Austrians put up with shit. Like it really has from the, and Swiss are pretty much trying to be the stronger player, which arguably they are. But also one of the VPs at Swiss told me, we had to fight tooth and nail to protect the Swissness of our brand, you know, and of our way of doing things. Because, you know, sometimes Frankfurt just has all these ideas as to how things are going to go. And, well, you know how I feel about Frankfurt, so we don't need to go down that route.
Yeah, well, let's see what happens with this top thing. Obviously, it won't be a controlling stake, so now, I guess the Portuguese can rest easy, but we'll see down the road what happens.
Let's jump into some Q&A. Okay, can I start with this one? Yeah, this is more of a comment rather than a question. The username is Chucklesome Aviation. He says, "Hi, Alex, hope you're doing well. I love your podcast, which you do with Dan, and I've been watching Dan since 2016. I first knew about you a couple of years ago and found your story very inspiring. I can relate a lot to both you and Dan in many ways. Yesterday, I flew to Amsterdam, and on my flight from London, I saw not one, but two passengers listening to On Air with Dan and Alex."
No way.
"They were sitting in front of me, and as their phone screens were so bright, I saw them on the Spotify page with your podcast album art and found it was so cool that I was listening to your episode as well, meaning that there were three of us on board listening. But I'm glad that your podcast is getting so popular. It's really well deserved, and it's the best podcast out there. Love to you both." That's a really nice, really nice message. Crazy that is the... that is the case. But
it just
maybe
makes
they
me
were
feel
traveling
like,
together and they.
It
know,
makes me feel
listened.
Like I shouldn't be sitting in like a random hotel room on the floor with my microphone right now late at night recording this. Like, I'm like, this is a real deal. But
I think you should come to Montreal and we address the assembly. I think we address 192 member states with the Alex and Dan, with the on-air legislative agenda that we have to not just fix, but elevate global aviation going forward.
Yeah.
Just a suggestion.
We could do it.
Yeah. And we justify it by saying, well, this guy just wrote into us and told us that he sat behind two guys listening to us on the podcast. So of course we're here addressing you guys.
Yeah, yeah. By that logic, there are a lot of people who should be airline CEOs or addressing airlines. So
yeah, I've seen people watch your, I've seen someone watching your video on a flight before.
I can't believe that.
Oh my God, what an awful way to spend a flight. Anyway, now moving on to the next question.
Yeah, I have a question here from Praveen, which I mean, you know, we love talking about U.S. carriers here on air. So I just find this quite funny. So Praveen says, hi, Nonstop Dan. I listen to your podcast every week and love the quirky conversation that you and Alex have. I wanted to ask you about Delta Airlines. What is your true opinion about them? Well, watch my latest review. And them being the only North American airline not to have flights to India. Should they do it? Are they not able because it wasn't profitable? Because they did fly to Mumbai from JFK right before COVID. AA flies 777-300 into Delhi daily. And of course, so does United. So this is interesting just because, well, okay, first of all, Delta is very, very conservative. United is the US airline that loves to test things. And that's the one thing I love about United, that their network team is totally open to saying, this winter, let's try a huge expansion in the Pacific or in Australia and see how that works. Or let's try this random, you know, route to Mallorca from New York or to Tenerife. And both of these have proven to be successful. So I love that their network team is very creative. Meanwhile, Delta and American just sort of sit there and go, don't know what to do. So while we've seen United, again, creatively launch flights to Dubai as part of their partnership with Emirates, the Gulf for the past, I guess, about decade has been an area that U.S. airlines don't want to touch. And that extends flying so far to India because ultra long haul is very pricey. It's difficult to get high enough yields. United manages, clearly American manages, but I think Delta just, they don't have an abundance of wide body aircraft. So I think they see it as, you know, an evaluation of where can we send our aircraft profitably. There are other places where it's easier. The flights are much shorter and they just don't have that presence in the region, the wider region of the Middle East and India, for it to be something that's important for them right now. But there are rumors that Delta might also be looking at launching flights to Riyadh soonish. So we'll see if that materializes because no, I'm not joking. That would be probably the most random route to ever launch, but maybe besides Doha to Gothenburg.
Okay. Had you said that without us knowing that Virgin were going there, I could be, okay, you know, I can see how because of the Sky Team and Saudia and Link and whatever, you can see how Delta would ultimately feed into the Saudia route network and passengers fly on and that boosts the Saudi Arabia hub, right, of Riyadh. But Delta alongside Virgin Atlantic? What world
so
are we living
random.
In? That's crazy. Yeah.
I know, but it to me it's just especially random because it is Delta. Also, American flies to Doha, but I just feel like Delta doesn't.
But American flies to Doha kind of on behalf of QR.
Yeah, exactly. And Delta just doesn't feel like the type of airline that goes to places where Americans don't want to go. It's like they're completely uninterested in serving foreign passengers.
They spend freaking decades writing to the White House crying about the Middle East airlines and saying that when one Saudi aircraft takes off, 15 Americans lose their jobs. These are what the campaign said. I invite you to go to YouTube and have a look at this crazy absolute nonsense that they were spreading in these campaigns that they've since let go of when they've realized if you can't beat them, join them.
Yeah, and the funny thing is all this time they're like, this is the reason we can't fly to India because these carriers are stealing our passengers. Meanwhile, United and American are flying there, so why is Delta now not doing it? Because what's different about them, I wonder?
That's a loaded question. S-Ben says, hi, Alex and Dan. My question is this. I have an upcoming trip where I have the choice of Air India business class or EVA Air business class. The obvious choice is EVA, but Air India would add 2 days extra at my destination. I've heard Air India is dreadful. What would you do?
This is a question. If the prices are the same, I would treat the flight as a wonderful experience and sacrifice 2 days at my destination by going on EVA. What about you?
Yeah, same. Next.
Oh, by the way, wait. Quick story about Air India. So I have a friend who went to become a yoga teacher in Rishikesh just last month. And she was telling me how she flew an Air India 787 there. And she didn't know it was a 787. Obviously, I did because she sent me photos of the plane. And she was like, I was on this rickety old plane. It felt like a bus. And I was like, you know you're on a literal Dreamliner that is the latest and greatest from Boeing. And then she's like, on the way back, it was so nice and clean and fresh. And I'm like, yeah, because you flew an Air India A350 that was delivered like a few weeks ago. So, yeah,
5 minutes ago.
Yeah, literally. So it was just so funny. I've never heard someone describe a 787. Like to her, it might as well have been an A300, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Guys, feel free to send in your questions and your anecdotes to us via Instagram. As usual, I'm Alex LHR on Instagram, and he is the nonstop Dan with the V because he's, you know, the.
Exactly.
And we will look forward to joining you same time, same place next week from the land of the maple syrup and ice hockey. I wish you a pleasant rest of your week. Dan, have a good one.
Hey, enjoy Montreal, eh? Or wait, I think A is like a question. But anyway, take care, guys. We'll see you next week on air. Bye-bye.
If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it. Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over 1 million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.